Thanks, Latham, for the invitation. And as you said, my close collaborators are also in this talk, and I'm happy to have sort of their presence and support if there are questions that concern them. So this talk is about a recent paper with Karsten Jedamczyk on an effect that can relieve the Hubble tension, and the effect concerns primordial magnetic fields. So we got quite excited about this with Karsten, and here are the reasons why. The primordial magnetic fields are an old topic of study in cosmology and astrophysics, primarily because of the observed magnetic fields in galaxies and clusters and in intergalactic space. So their origin is not fully explained by astrophysics, and people often appeal to the presence of magnetic fields in the early universe, the primordial magnetic fields that could serve as seeds for the fields we are observing. And if magnetic fields were in primordial plasma at the time of recombination and just before recombination, then it was shown by my collaborator Karsten and his colleagues that they would induce inhomogeneities in the baryon density, which we call clumping, and that would speed the recombination up. So that would result in a faster recombination that would lead to a smaller sound horizon at decoupling, resulting in a higher value of H when doing parameter fits to the CMB spectra. And that helps to resolve this 4 plus sigma discrepancy between the value of the Hubble constant that is inferred from the CMB and that measured more directly using calibrated supernovae. And as a byproduct, it helps to reduce or practically eliminate the small tension that there is between the amplitude, S8 amplitude, the clustering amplitude that's predicted by the best fit Lambda CDM model, and that measured by large-scale structure surveys such as the dark energy survey. So we find a very nice detection of this clumping effect. And if you ask what is the strength of the magnetic field that gives you enough clumping to help reduce the Hubble tension, it happens to be of the right order of magnitude to also explain the fields we see in galaxies, clusters, and intergalactic space without requiring additional dynamo action, this large-scale dynamo action. So this is very exciting, and it motivates further studies of primordial magnetic fields, and this is a highly testable proposal. There will be observations in the future that would allow you to clearly find further evidence if magnetic fields are there at this level. So now that I told you everything you need to know about my talk, let me go slower and sort of introduce all these things systematically. So I'll start by reviewing the tensions and primordial magnetic fields, then go through this baryon clumping effect that's at the heart of the solution that we propose, and then show our results and discuss some implications. So let me quickly review how CMB constrains the Hubble constant. The key observation from a CMB spectrum is that it has peaks. So they correspond to oscillations or sound waves in primordial plasma. And satellites like WMAP and Planck have measured these peaks exquisitely well, and we can measure the position of the main peak, L peak, to great accuracy. So that gives you the angular scale corresponding to the sound horizon at last scattering, so which we can call RS. So what you measure is actually the angle. So it's the ratio between the sound horizon and the distance to last scattering R star. That on its own is not enough to constrain the Hubble constant, but what you need is actually to measure three key parameters. So the distance to last scattering, or R star, depends on the density of radiation little omega r, the density of matter, and the Hubble constant h. And it also depends on the upper bound on this integral, which is the redshift of last scattering z star. And the sound speed depends on is given by a similar integral, except you have a speed of sound here instead of the speed of light. And the integral is from the z star to infinity. And it depends on the baryon density separately from the total matter density and the radiation density. So we know the radiation density very well from the temperature of the cosmic microwave background, 2.7 Kelvin. So we know the photon density, and we can deduce the total radiation density if we assume that we understand the neutrinos. So we need to know three parameters, omega baryons, omega matter, and H. So three unknowns. And CMB, fortunately, provides us three numbers. So the peak gives you the ratio of the R star to RS, but then you also can measure the ratio of omega matter to omega radiation from the rise of the spectrum at in a range of multiples between sort of tens and hundreds. It's primarily sensitive to the so-called early ISW effect there. And the difference between the heights of the peaks gives you the baryon density, omega baryon. So you have essentially three pieces of information in the spectrum. You have three unknowns, and you can determine all of these three unknowns very well. And that's what Planck did, measuring all the parameters, including H, with really small error bars. So you can see in this plot, in a RS, where RS here is the sound horizon at the baryon decoupling. It's slightly different, but related to the sound horizon at last gathering and H naught. So you can see that Planck gives a really tight constraint on both parameters here, because it can measure all these parameters really well. Now, baryon acoustic oscillations also probe the same physics. It's the oscillations that you see, or a feature that you see now in a distribution of galaxies, correlation function of the galaxy distribution. But by themselves, baryon acoustic oscillations cannot constrain all of these necessary parameters. They can essentially constrain the angular scale. So from BAO, you can also measure the angle to a given redshift, to the feature at a given redshift, and that constrains a band in a RSH node plane, which goes at this angle. So both CMB and baryon acoustic oscillations rely on you knowing how to essentially estimate the sound horizon in the early universe, how to calculate it. And the Hubble tension represented in this plot, which I borrowed from a review paper from a year ago, clearly illustrates that the tension is not just between measurements in the early and the late universe, but more specifically, it's a tension between measurements that require knowledge of the physics at decoupling, namely CMB and BAO, and measurements that do not. So measurements that don't require any recombination input from recombination physics are summarized here on the right, in the right portion of the plot, and they include calibrated supernovae, supernovae calibrated in various different ways. Most prominently, it's the Schuss measurement, which is supernova calibrated on Cepheid variable stars. But there are also measurements that don't depend on supernovae, like Holikow, which uses the lensing of quasars, time delays of distant quasar images, and Mega Mesa cosmology project, which uses observations of emission from water vapor or orbiting black holes. So the last two are independent of supernovae and also give you values of the Hubble constant that are significantly larger than those inferred from Planck and BAO combined with other measurements. So this gives you a hint that maybe something is missing in our understanding of the physics of at recombination. In addition, there is this less attention between the amplitude of clustering on the 8 megaparsec scale, quantified by this number sigma 8 or a related number S8, between that measured by dark energy survey and KIDS, which is another weak lensing survey. So this band is shown with a gray area here, and you can see that it's to the left of the Planck data point. It's not a huge tension. It's at the level of maybe 2 sigma at most. Nevertheless, there is tension, and that's something that has been noted. So now that I told you about the tensions, let me introduce what you need to know about the magnetic fields to understand the rest of my talk. So magnetic fields are known to exist in practically all gravitationally bound structures that we have seen in space. And when it comes to galaxies, pretty much every galaxy where a measurement has been attempted, they have shown presence of magnetic fields at the level of microgauss, between 1 and 10 microgauss. And the most common explanation to them is astrophysical, that these magnetic fields were generated through a dynamo mechanism over the course of the evolution of the galaxy. But microgauss level fields are also seen in galaxies at very high redshifts, during times where galaxies were so young that they wouldn't have the time to rotate sufficient number of times to generate large magnetic fields. Yet they also have magnetic fields at the level of a microgauss. So the question is, how could that happen if the explanation is the dynamo? So that points to a primordial origin, that magnetic fields were already there in the plasma, and they collapsed and amplified as the galaxy was forming and the matter was collapsing through gravitational collapse. There is also evidence that magnetic fields are there in the intergalactic space, and that comes from observations of gamma rays, namely very high energy gamma rays, the TeV blazars. And let me explain briefly how that works, because it's a very promising way to look for primordial magnetic fields. So I'm referring to a line of work which became quite popular following this paper about 10 years ago, where it was claimed that there is a lower bound on magnetic fields of about 10 to minus 16 gauss, and corresponding to magnetic fields that would be coherent, correlated on a megaparsec scale, so a much larger scale than a galaxy, so intergalactic space. And it's the physics here is quite simple. It comes from the fact that you expect to see GeV level gamma rays surrounding a TeV blazar. So a blazar is a gamma ray of TeV energy that shoots at you with some periodicity. And as this TeV gamma ray or photon propagates, it has a large cross section to hit another photon, which would be just a loose photon of extragalactic background light, or EBL. So the energy is so high that there is a high cross section for them to produce an electron positron pair. So those electron and positron pairs would travel some distance, and after a while they'll start hitting CMB photons and upscattering them into gamma ray, GeV level, GeV energy gamma rays. So you would therefore expect to see a halo of GeV level gamma rays surrounding a TeV level blazar. However, if there is a magnetic field, this electron-positron pairs would be deflected by the magnetic field in opposite ways, and that would dilute or eliminate the GeV gamma ray halo in your line of sight. So you won't see, or will see less of gamma rays if there is a magnetic field. In fact, it kind of predicts that if you see a halo, and there is a magnetic field, it would be likely a pair of halos corresponding to those produced by the positron and the electron. And more recently, there was a paper which claimed that there is indeed evidence for such pair halos around blazars. So that's also quite interesting. So there's this evidence for magnetic fields in voids coming from gamma rays. And there is also evidence for magnetic fields present in filaments, like in a few megaparsec long ridge connecting two merging galaxy clusters. So there was this paper in Science a year ago based on LOFAR observation of radio emission coming from this ridge. And the authors find it very difficult to explain that using the usual astrophysical mechanisms. And they suggest that it corresponds to a magnetic field in essentially plasma, not produced due to astrophysical sources. And the magnetic field is of order 0.1 to 0.3 microgauss in this filament. So that's the observational evidence, which gets stronger and stronger. And it got to the point that it's difficult to ignore the possibility of primordial magnetic fields over the past 10 years. On the other hand, theorists have speculated for a long time that magnetic fields must be produced in early universe, at least at some level. For example, in phase transitions in early universe, it's not a question of whether magnetic fields are produced or not, but a question of whether it's enough of them and of sufficient strength, of sufficient sort of spectral features that to explain the galactic magnetic fields. But it's certainly true that they would be produced because magnetic fields are quite generic in plasmas. So now let's suppose that such a primordial magnetic field exists, and that would be a stochastic magnetic field, meaning it's not a magnetic field that's sort of uniform over the entire space, but it's a random field. You could imagine it having no uniform component at all, just a random vector spread across the volume. And it's produced at some early time, could be during the inflation or at the end of inflation or during a phase transition, such as the electroweak phase transition that would be at the, let's say, TeV, 100 GeV energies. And once it's produced, the magnetic field would remain frozen in on large scales, meaning it's sort of glued to the plasma. So its flux through any area that you would draw inside the volume would remain the same. It moves as the plasma moves. And it would be, on large scales, it would be scaling with the expansion of the universe like any other radiation. So the amplitude B would go as 1 over A squared. So radiation density is like B squared. And so the square root of B would go as 1 over A squared. So square root of the radiation density. On small scales, of course, magnetic fields would dissipate and lose energy, but on large scales, their evolution is quite simple. Now, magnetic fields would be characterized by a spectrum, just like other things in cosmology were characterized by their spectrum. So here, little b is the Fourier transform of the magnetic field strength. And the spectrum here has symmetrical and the parity odd parts. The symmetrical part, S of K, and is a parlo in most magnetogenesis models. And this exponent N is quite generically equal to 2 for fields generated in phase transitions. It's a simple consequence of causality. Because phase transitions produce magnetic fields on the scale of a horizon at some time, let's say during the electroweak epoch. So they're just injected into the plasma on the length scale corresponding to the horizon at the electroweak time. And subsequently, they evolve, and some of this magnetic strength is transferred to larger scales, etc. But on very large scales, the tail of the spectrum is always going to fall off as n equal 2 simply because of the causality. And inflationary mechanisms are sort of less predictive. The simplest, earliest models of inflationary magnetogenesis predicted scale invariant magnetic fields, but there are other models that predict other spectral indices, and so that's much more model dependent. Now, that's pretty much what you need to know about primordial magnetic fields. And now let me maybe pause for a second and see if there are any questions before I move on to explain the clumping effect. Okay.
So maybe could I ask one question? So,
sure.
So the, actually, no, I'll hold on.
Okay. All right. So here are the equations that you use to study magnetic fields in plasmas. There are three equations. The top one is the early equation, essentially telling you how a volume of plasma would move in response to different types of forces that are relevant. Then you have the continuity equation and the equation for the evolution of the magnetic field, which you derive from your Maxwell's equations. So the top equation has force terms corresponding to the pressure, which comes the CS squared gradient rho term. That's the pressure term. Then you have the gravity term, the gradient of the potential. Then you have the viscosity, and you have the Lorentz force term on the right. During the times just before recombination, not all of these terms are relevant, and some of them can be ignored. In particular, you can safely ignore the gravity term. You can ignore the effects of finite conductivity in the plasma, because on relevant scales that I'll be describing, plasma is practically perfectly conducting, so you ignore this magnetic diffusion term. And the viscosity term can be well approximated by just the linear term in velocity, because you are in a regime where the Reynolds number is very small. So you're very far from the turbulent regime. Everything is nice and friction dominated. So this friction coefficient here is determined by the photon mean free path, which is also known among cosmologists as the silk damping scale. So essentially, the viscosity here is provided by photons hitting the baryons. The Lorentz term can be broken into two parts, and you see that there is this term, which is the gradient of the magnetic field density, gradient of B squared, and that's the source of, that's the force, basically, that's going to drive the compression of baryons towards regions of smaller magnetic field density. So this term would prefer the baryons to go towards B squared equals zero. Now, there are two very important regimes here, depending on which length scales you look at. So depending on whether you study evolution of your baryon density on scales larger than the photon mean free path or smaller than the photon mean free path, you get very different physics. So on large scales, on scales larger than the photon length, the fluid is what cosmologists mostly remember from their cosmology courses. It's a tightly coupled baryon photon fluid, which is largely incompressible with a large speed of sound, which is something like C squared equals 1/3. But well below this mean free path, it's not the case. So there, the photons no longer tightly coupled to baryons, and baryons behave more like a compressible gas, which is heavily damped by the residual photons that are floating around. So these baryons can actually have growing density perturbations, and that's at the heart of the effect. So this magnetic forcing term due to gradients of B squared will drive baryon density perturbations on scales that are well below the photon mean pre-path. For us, that's basically 1 kiloparsec scale, much smaller than the silk damping scale, which is a megaparsec scale. Now, the strength of this, or the magnitude of these density fluctuations, grows up until it reaches roughly order 1, because there are two things that oppose it growing further. One is the pressure due to just the baryonic pressure, and that's going to counteract the compression beyond this ratio of the Alvin velocity to the sound speed squared. And the other effect is that magnetic field itself will decay. So as magnetic field drives density perturbations, it also dies because it takes energy from the magnetic field to make these perturbations grow. And that's the basically of order one. It only allows densities to grow until they become order one. So the effect is that delta rho over rho can at most be of order one. It's the smaller of these two numbers.
Now, could I ask about the previous slide?
Yes, please.
Where did the number 1 kiloparsec come from? Why is that the relevant scale? I know it's smaller than the silk damping scale, but why are we considering not smaller or larger scales?
Yeah, so it has to be much smaller than the megaparsec scale because you want the speed of sound to be sufficiently small to allow the growth of inhomogeneities. So on larger scales than 1 kiloparsec, the speed of sound would gradually become larger. And also you need time for perturbations to grow. So they start growing, I guess, on all scales, but they only on 1 kiloparsec scales, they grow sufficiently big by the time of last scattering. Now, why they cannot be much smaller is because magnetic fields, sort of the peak of the magnetic field spectrum is at 1 kiloparsec, at around 1 kiloparsec scales. So the magnetic field strength drops rapidly on scales that are smaller than
I mean, that's observationally you're talking about?
Scales smaller than 1 kiloparsec. No, that's something that's understood from numerical simulations of primordial magnetic fields.
What is the physical process that gives you this cutoff?
Cutoff?
Why does the magnetic field peak there?
The magnetic fields dissipate their energy for a variety of reasons. So there is, of course, the scale of the finite conductivity, where you can no longer treat plasma as perfectly conducting, and magnetic fields dissipate on that scale. But that's a very small scale. Okay. But also, there are magnetic fields drive flows and continuously lose energy due to losing their energy due to driving these plasma flows, and that happens on scales sort of between the plasma conductivity scale and where most of the magnetic field strength is. So the peak of the magnetic field spectrum continuously shifts as the universe expands and magnetic fields evolve. It constantly shifts from the small scales to large and larger scales. Uh-huh. And by the time of recombination, you find it at 1 kiloparsec scale.
And this is 1 kiloparsec co-moving, the current 1 kiloparsec co-moving.
Yes. Okay. I mean, Karsten, do you want to add anything about this?
Yeah, I think you did explain it fine. You know, it is really something which comes out of the simulations of fields. And there is a correlation between how much magnetic field you have altogether and on which scale it sits. And that correlation is given by the evolution of magnetic fields. So if we want to have enough magnetic field to relieve the Hubble tension, then we can tell you exactly where it would sit. And that's about 1 kiloparsec.
Okay, thanks. And one other question, I don't know whether maybe you're going to explain it in a moment, but if not, maybe I could ask about it now. So you're going to want the density perturbations to grow from 10 to the minus 5 up to almost 1 on these scales, or up to point nearly yeah. 1 on these scales by the time of recombination. Is there a simple argument to say how it manages to do that in the required time? Like, I guess you have the time between when those scales re-enter the horizon and recombination to grow by that amount.
So the physics is essentially given by this equation. So you have a force here, given by gradient of p squared, and in a heavily damped regime, you're essentially in a steady state where friction force and the driving force are approximately equal. So you can equate alpha v to gradient of b squared, and that roughly tells you essentially the rate at which and then you put that back into your equation for the density perturbations, which depend on this velocity term, and that gives you the estimate. So the estimate, there is an analytical estimate that was done in Carson's paper with Tom Abel here in 2011. Yes, there is this argument. And then it was subsequently also confirmed in numerical simulations.
Mm-hmm. So at the bottom equation there is the delta rho over rho at which basically the perturbation will saturate. It will grow to that size and then not grow beyond that. Is that right?
Yes.
And could you remind me? I think you said it, but I missed it. V sub A is...
It's the so-called Alvin velocity. So these are motions of ions in the plasma in response to magnetic field lines moving around. So
And that's not real. And then the CS on the bottom is not the sort of familiar root 3 times
no,
less
it's
than
the
that. It's this much smaller.
So on this scale, it would be much smaller. It would be the sound speed of the sort of almost decoupled baryon gas.
And so in practice, that fraction ends up being, in this particular case, does it end up being much bigger than 1 or much less than 1 or comparable to 1?
It's on the order of 1, but a bit less than 1.
Uh-huh. And so what actually happens is that it's not that the 1 kiloparsec scales begin grow, that their density perturbation begin growing when they enter the horizon and then just reach saturation at the time of recombination. It's that they reach the saturation point sometime before recombination and then sit there.
That entering the horizon is not relevant here. So we can forget about the horizon. They were inside the horizon already. And gravity is not important.
In other words, the time to reach saturation is much less than the time available to them.
Time.
Yeah, I just mean they have plenty of time to reach saturation before recombination arrives.
Could I add?
Yes. Uh huh. Please, Carsten.
Magnetic fields, which are of order of 10, maybe 30 picogauss, which sit on kiloparsec scales, like even by the evolution, they will just have the time the universe spent going up to the recombination. So they just will have saturated shortly before recombination.
So larger than picogauss fields will do the trick.
About 10 picogauss, which is a small number, you know, a bit more than that, actually.
And does the speed scale as the, I guess it scales as the square of the magnetic field, is that right?
The
speed scales as a linear power, the Alphine speed of the magnetic field, you know.
Oh, sorry. I mean the rate at which the perturbations grow square scales as the square of the magnetic field, according to that balance equation that Levon was.
It does, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you.
Hello, Levon.
Michael,
just a quick comment, which may be irrelevant, but.
Oh, hi, John. Sorry.
Hello, hello, Lynn. In an exact homogeneous universe, FRW, there's only time dependence, so the electromagnetic field F mu is zero. So this, you wouldn't expect large megaparsec scale density fluctuations from the magnetic field. The magnetic field, it requires some inhomogeneity to be present.
Yeah, so this magnetic fields that I'm talking about are not homogeneous, they're highly inhomogeneous.
That's right, yeah.
Yeah.
Can I, since you've been stuck, can I ask you another clarifying question?
Yeah.
So I imagine, I don't have a lot of intuition for the magnetohydrodynamics, but I imagine that the equations you're using break down on sufficiently small scales where it's wrong to think of it as being a fluid rather than, you know, particles colliding somehow. And yeah. My intuition somehow is that there's, in this before decoupling regime, there's only really one scale for all those collisions because they're all tightly bound to each other. And so I'm thinking that L gamma is going to be similar to the scale where this magnetohydrodynamic thing breaks down, which is, I think, it's not the right picture. So, no. So what sets the scale where the fluid picture breaks down?
So the conductivity scale of the plasma. So you have this term here, the eta in the bottom equation, the right-hand side, you have the what's called the magnetic the magnetic diffusion term. And that's the proportional to the inverse of the conductivity.
Mm-hmm.
And that sets a length scale, which is around one parsec.
Ah.
Okay. So on scales that we are, the scales we are talking about, a kiloparsec and especially megaparsec, it's completely negligible. So for all practical purposes, we can assume that plasma has infinite conductivity, perfectly conducting.
Lavon, do you mind if I,
yes,
if
please.
I add to this? In fact, the scale, this magnetic diffusion scale, is much, much lower than one parsec.
Okay.
What sets the scale between where you can treat the MHD as a fluid or you have to treat it as a plasma is, of course, the mean free path of particles, like electrons and protons, you know. Their mean free path sets the scale. Now, the mean free path is much below a kiloparsec, so you can, like, well treat this problem as a fluid.
But it's very different. That scale is very different from what L gamma in the other slide that we just saw, is it?
Yes, it's much smaller than L gamma. L gamma is about 1 megaparsec. We are on scales of kiloparsecs, and the mean free path of electrons and protons is much smaller than the kiloparsec.
Thank you.
Okay. So, great. So I'm glad that people are interrupting. It helps. So now, if you now have this inhomogeneities in baryon density, you can look at the rate of the charged fraction of particles, so the ionization or recombination rate. So Ne in this equation is the density of free electrons. And you see that the rate depends on two things on the right-hand side. The first term on the right-hand side is essentially the product, depends on the product of the electron and proton densities. Hence, you have this Ne squared. So that drives the recombination or the decrease in the free electron density. It comes with a negative sign. And the other term is the opposite process by which things get reionized again. So it's only proportional to the number density of the neutral hydrogen, which I guess gets hit by photons and gets split back into protons and electrons. So the key observation here is that the first term on the right-hand side is quadratic. So it's Ne squared. And so if you have an inhomogeneous distribution, then the average of Ne squared is going to be greater than Ne average squared. And so that's at the heart of the speed up in an inhomogeneous distribution of baryons. It's going to increase the importance of the first term and make the derivative more negative. So that's going to make things recombine faster. And that was shown by Karsten and Tom Abel in 2011. You can see on the left plot is the ionized fraction as a function of redshift for two different values of this so-called clumping parameter that I'll introduce in a minute. And you can see that in both, so lambda CDM or the conventional no magnetic field case is the solid black line. The dotted line and the dashed lines are the case with inhomogeneities. And in that same paper, they have shown the effect it would have on the temperature spectrum of the CMB, shifting the peaks to the right, as well as having some impact on their heights. So at that time, Karsten and Tom, they put the upper bound, they used this to put an upper bound on magnetic fields, which was much stronger than any other bound based on the CMB at the time. So with Hubble tension becoming a very hot topic in the past few years, so it became reasonable to ask, well, if there is this tension, what would happen if instead of putting an up, like instead of just feeding to CMB, what if you put Hubble data coming from other measurements as an independent prior, or just combine your CMB and Hubble data together? Would that then lead to some evidence of primordial magnetic fields? And that's what we set out to do with Karsten. We have implemented this inhomogeneous recombination model in CAM and COSMO-MC. We used two different models called M1 and MM2 to describe the distribution of baryons, the inhomogeneous distribution of baryons at the time of recombination. And the reason we use two models is because the actual quantitative results depend on the shape of the probability distribution function. So these two models have two different shapes. And even though the most important contribution comes from the second moment, or this clumping parameter B, other moments of this distribution also play a role. So in our in both models, there is a free parameter, which is this clumping parameter, which is the second moment of the distribution of the baryon density. The data that we consider is the 2018 Planck, including lensing. The measurements of the Hubble constant from Schuss, Holikow, and MCP, which are basically the three independent determinations of H0. And we also try fits to all other possible data sets that exist in COSMO-MC, including the supernovae, BAO, and DES. So let me start by looking at just the fit to Planck alone. As I said, when Karsten did the fit earlier in 2011, he found an upper bound, and that hasn't changed. So when you fit the clumping model to just the CMB, you don't get a detection of clumping, but there is a strong degeneracy between the clumping parameter and the value of H0. You can see this, there is this elongated contour. So that indicates that CMB could be equally happy with zero clumping or a non-zero clumping. And that's quite possible, since there is a lot of all kinds of degeneracies in CMB. And so what happens when you add the combination of Schuss, Holikow, and MCP is that you now clearly shift the peak in H0 and you to a larger value, and you get a detection of clumping. So with M1, the clumping factor is detected. It's equal to roughly 0.6. And it's at the higher than 4 sigma detection. And H naught clearly shifts to a larger value. Here it's around, for M1, it's around 71. And the nice thing about it is that it doesn't actually spread the size of the contour, meaning it's clearly inconsistent with a smaller H naught. So it's a different corner in the parameter space altogether. It's not just adding a parameter to increase the freedom for parameters to take more values, a larger range of values. Sorry, I'm drawing really hard. And you can see the effect on omega meta that in this model, the capital omega meta is smaller. And this is showing how the tension is relieved next to the shoes data. Yeah?
Levan, can you go back to that plot?
Yeah.
So, I mean, the fact that the H naught omega matter parameter space, the blue contours are inconsistent with the red ones. Mm-hmm. Does that suggest that you are still have some tension? Because it seems that where if you basically data sets are inconsistent with each other.
So I'm comparing two different models. In one model, I get omega meta H naught in one place, and in another model, I get them in a different place. So we know there is inconsistency between Planck and H naught measurements, right, within lambda CDM. But mm-hmm. I'm not quite sure I understand your question, Yash.
Well, I mean, it seems that the red model should include the blue as well, because
so that's the whole point. It's once you allow for clumping and you put a prior on H naught or add this H3 yeah. data, it clearly wants to be in a different place.
No, but wait a minute, these are all the same models, right?
So you just one is lambda CDM.
Oh, I see. Okay.
Blue is lambda CDM. It's the Planck.
Oh, right.
Okay. Speed lambda CDM. Mm.
Okay, now I got confused. Right. So the blue is just the lambda CDM. It doesn't have clumping factor. Okay. Yeah.
Sorry, but why isn't Niyash right that if the clumping were zero, you'd just get it should be lambda CDM?
If clumping was fixed at zero, it should have been lambda CDM.
Yeah.
It's not the same data as well. So you see here, it's not Planck plus H3 lambda CDM. I have a comparison for that as well, but here I want to show specifically this just to show that it moves you to a different place.
Right. Okay.
Levon.
Yes, please.
It's been known for some years that in inhomogeneous cosmological models, you have two H scales, Hubble scales, perpendicular and radial. Mm-hmm. And if you have spatial dependence, then the radial Hubble scale changes to H naught. And there are models showing that you can fit this tension, Hubble tension, and fit the CMP data. There's been a lot of published data papers on this subject. Mm-hmm. So, however, of course, you have a mechanism for producing the inhomogeneity.
Yeah. Thanks. Yeah, it's. I'm happy to learn a bit more about this. They are all. Yeah. Thanks, John. Thanks for the comment. So this is how it looks in comparison to the shoes data. You see that with M1, you move into this 2 sigma band of shoes, and M2 doesn't do as well, but it also moves in the right direction. Now you could ask, well, if CMB prefers zero clumping when taken on its own, and now
Levan, could I just ask what is it? Is there a simple summary of what the difference is between the distributions M1 and M2?
Yeah, M2 has a larger third moment.
Okay, and M1 is basically Gaussian?
It has a larger positive skewness, yeah, M2. And okay. So we have an analytical derivation with Karsten that we haven't published yet, but so the effect is stronger for distributions that have smaller third moment. And okay. We just wanted to show the range of possibilities.
Okay.
Okay. So, of course, what I showed you, and I guess Nyayesh in part picked up on it, is I'm essentially adding additional data and then saying the fit moves. Does it mean that the fit to CNB gets worse in this case? Because without H3, Planck would still prefer to give you zero clumping. Now, for that, you can look at the chi-square distribution of just the CNB part. And you see that indeed the fit gets worse, so chi-square increases. However, the increase is on the order of 1 sigma. So it's not a substantial degradation of the fit. It's, I would say, a rather negligible degradation of the fit. So we also calculated the so-called probability to exceed number, which for Planck lambda CDM is around 20% for their best fit. And in our model for M1 here, it's 17%. So going from 20% to 17% in PTE is not significant at all. So the conclusion here is that both give acceptable fits. And Planck data is known to have some order 1 sigma tensions scattered all over the place. Some tensions are even bigger than 1 sigma within Planck data set. So it is perfectly fine to have small differences in chi-square when trying different models.
Don't you have to increase the distance to the last horizon to get the peaks correct?
So, yeah, so that's the point of this effect, that you reduce the speed of, so you reduce the sound horizon. So magnetic fields introduce this inhomogeneities that speed up recombination and reduce the sound horizon at last scattering. Therefore, the last scattering has to be closer to you, and that requires a larger H-naught. So you increase H-naught to compensate for the shift of the peaks, and that's how you get the larger H-naught.
Yeah, because in many models now that claim to resolve Hubble tension, it all comes about because you reduce the sound horizon scale, but you have to compensate for that some way. And you're doing it this way.
I compensate. Yes, you reduce the sound horizon, and that then solves the Hubble tension by a larger H naught. Yeah. So this is about the other tension. So here I plot the dark energy survey contours for in a S8 omega metaplane, and you see that the Planck lambda CDM is in a gentle tension. It's outside the 1 sigma region, and in our models the contours move well into good 1 sigma overlap. So it's just as a byproduct it relieves that tension. So, and this is what we sometimes refer to as our money plot. It's how you solve both tensions in one go in the S8 H-naught plane. Now, if you look at what happens to other cosmological parameters, they roughly stay the same. There's no significant change neither in their central values nor in uncertainties around those values, which is a good thing. As I said before, we don't just add a parameter and increase the freedom in the parameter space to accommodate the tension between two data sets. That wouldn't solve the Hubble tension. It would just make the Hubble constant unknown. So we don't increase the uncertainty in the Hubble constant. We just shift its estimate value to a different value. Now, you could ask what happens when you add other data sets.
Sorry, Levan, can you go back? I just want to ask you about the last line here.
Yes,
so, please. So if you just look at the chi-squared best fit, it does look like you are higher by, what is it? Is it 15 or is that right?
You should compare chi-squares of the same data. So the left column is only CMB.
Oh.
So it has a smaller chi-square.
Right.
The last three columns are Planck plus H3. So you should compare, let's say, second and third column.
Second and third column. But those are both have this H3. H3 is, what is H3?
It's the combination of shoes, holy cow.
Okay. I see. So you're
but
saying
you can also see the individual chi-squares.
Mm.
Like you can see, for example, that chi-square plique, they're all within one sigma.
Okay. I see. Okay. Thanks.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So now if you add all the other data sets, most prominently BAO, actually the other data sets like Supernova and DES only make our detection stronger, especially if you just combine Planck and DES, because it does help to reduce a tension between Planck and DES when it comes to SI and omega meta. But BAO is something that doesn't allow you to go to very significant changes in the Hubble constant. So it pushes the best fit value of H node back to something like 70.5. And the reason for that is because the same change in a sound horizon requires a different change in H naught depending on at which redshift you look at. So CMB is at redshift 1000, and there, even a small change in the sound horizon results in a big shift in H naught. But the BAO, which are essentially at redshift 0.5 or so, there, the same shift in the sound horizon results in a much more modest shift in H node. So it's not easy to please both CMB and BAO at the same time. So we are going to study this in much more details, and we're going to write a separate paper about what happens to the BAO and CMB plus BAO in our class of models. So some implications.
Sorry, Levan, I muted you for, I tried to unmute myself and I muted you for a second. So you were muted for the past few seconds. Yeah.
Okay. So if you ask how much magnetic field you need to produce such an effect, so enough to solve the Hubble tension, then from what Karsten and his collaborators learned from numerical simulations, MHD simulations, is that it's somewhere between 0.01 and 0.1 nanogauss. Let's have 0.05 nanogauss as sort of a target number in our minds. Then you could ask what happens at low redshifts as you go past recombination into the present day universe. And there, it does depend on the scale, on a spectral shape of the magnetic fields. This is something I introduced in the beginning of my talk. Depending on whether they are, let's say, scale invariant or have blue spectra, such as those produced in phase transitions, the evolution will be different. And this is a plot from a paper by Karsten and Andrei Saveliev from about 2 years ago, where you can see the solid line, the thick solid line is the magnetic field strength as you go through recombination, which is at in their units is A equals 1. And you can see that scale invariant fields largely keep their amplitude. It's only diminished slightly, but this causal fields with blue spectra experience a sudden drop by roughly a factor of 6 as you go through recombination. And the reason for that drop is essentially the fact that the density of charged particles suddenly drops by a huge factor. And a lot of the magnetic field strength that was concentrated on small scales just suddenly disappears. And because most of the strength was on small scales, you just sort of cut off a part of the spectrum where you had a lot of magnetic field strength. And so if you had 0.05 nanogauss at around before recombination, then after you would be left with just 0.01 nanogauss if you had blue spectrum. Now in both cases, there is rich phenomenology, and that's something that we should investigate, and we are going to investigate, and many people, I'm sure, will feel compelled to do it. And so these are the different lines of investigations. Most importantly for us at this point is to understand exactly what the probability distribution function of baryons is at recombination, essentially the difference between the model M1 and M2. And that's what we're studying now with detailed MHD simulations. And it's not just what it was at recombination, but as it evolved with time from before to after recombination. It's a time-dependent process, and that will be very important for our proposal to become more predictive. As I mentioned also, this is a nice way to resolve the Hubble tension because it doesn't require new physics. There's no exotic physics here. And if magnetic fields were in the plasma, you would, at this level, to solve the Hubble tension, you would see them in other ways. So future CMB probes that are proposed to look at spectral distortions of the CMB would be able to see evidence of magnetic fields of this type, of this strength, through mu and y type spectral distortions. If you're lucky, and it's a scale invariant field, and it's as strong as 0.1 nanogauss, meaning it's towards the upper bound of the range that I mentioned, then it could be seen by stage 4 CMB experiments through Faraday rotation. And as I mentioned, this gamma ray astronomy is a very promising way for looking for magnetic fields in voids, and with more data, that will become more and more exact and accurate. And finally, radio astronomy can look for synchrotron and Faraday rotation, all kinds of evidence of magnetic fields in intercluster medium and coming from distant radio sources and probing the rotation measure in a distant, in a space in between. So there are all these interesting ways that we can look forward to in the future for confirming or ruling out our proposal. So that brings me to the end of my talk. And since I already told you all the punchlines at the very beginning, I'm not going to read through these lines and just open the floor for questions. So thank you.
All right. Thank you for that very nice talk. Neil, go for it.
Thanks. So I had two or maybe three questions. Just to understand the scales of these baryon fluctuations that were induced, so you were saying that to get order one baryon fluctuations, the Alfvén velocity has to be of order the baryon sound speed. Is that what you said?
It's just below that, yeah.
So to get some intuition about this Alfvén velocity, should I think of the ratio of the sound speed to the Alfvén velocity, squared? Is that ratio squared something like the ratio of the baryon pressure to the energy density in the B fields?
Yes, it's pretty much that. Yes, it's the ratio between the force exerted by the magnetic field or pressure applied by the magnetic field to the pressure from the
beta. Yeah, so sort of like the plasma beta, you're saying, has to be of order one.
it approaches one, yeah.
I see. Okay. So at earlier times, you know, for example, in like BBN, you know, similarly then, you know, well, right, you know, so then the energy density in the B fields would be much larger than the pressure in the baryons, right? So therefore then similarly then would I expect enormous or, should I similarly expect, you know, very large fractional density fluctuations in the baryons at the time of BBN, for example?
So I think the key difference between that time of recombination around the BBN is that you don't have this compressibility. The fluid is the plasma is in a turbulent regime there, so you don't have this viscosity dominated regime where the speed of sound is low and you can and the density fluctuations can actually grow. So there they would be quickly the speed of sound would be larger and
But the energy also fluctuations in your B field
dominated by the turbulence, so there would be a lot of mixing happening with turbulence causing essentially washing out the growth of any baryon perturbations.
Could I add? I'm sorry.
Yeah.
You would be totally right about this if there would be only neutrinos, because like at doing BBN at some point, you know, like shortly before, the baryons would decouple from the neutrinos and the same thing would happen. But the photons are still coupled during BBN to the baryons. And so the speed of sound is effectively the speed of sound, speed of light over a square root of 3. And the magnetic fields you expect naturally from the evolution during Big Bang nucleosynthesis have much lower energy density than the radiation energy density, so they won't be able to push the gas into fluctuations of order unity. The key is that the speed of sound is very large.
I see. That's what you're saying. I see. So to get these large fluctuations, like the baryon sound speed has to be much smaller, you're saying, than the photon sound speed. I see.
The total sound speed, like which is the relevant one for the baryons, has to be much smaller than C over square root of 3.
Right.
That only happens when the photons decouple, because there's no more, you know, like radiation participating like on those scales.
Okay, great, thanks. My last question, I guess was about the numbers. So you mentioned that you need something in order like 0.1 nanogauss to do this. So is that today?
So that's in co-moving units. So by convention, magnetic fields are rescaled to the strength they would have today. So the real magnetic field would have been much larger at that time.
Yeah, yeah.
Point 0.1 milligauss, is that right? Basically a million times bigger?
0.05 nanogauss is the number. 0.05 nanogauss in co-moving units.
And that would be, but with that A squared, we're supposed to use that A squared factor, so that's point, that at the time of recombination, that would be 0.05 milligauss.
Larger by 10 to the 6 at redshift of 1,000.
Okay. So my question, I guess, was about, you know, constraints on, your constraints on the, on the level of the intergalactic magnetic fields coming from like fast radio bursts, for example. Mm-hmm. Do you happen to know what the order of magnitude of those bounds is?
Fast radio bursts, I don't know about off the top of my head the constraints from fast radio bursts from cosmic rays.
Bounds on the rotation measure, right? Uh-huh. From these FRBs.
And I see.
Some bound on the intergalactic magnetic field. I just don't remember like what that bound is.
I I don't remember either. Maybe Tanmay, do you know?
Yeah, I don't think that, at least the one paper that I saw, I don't think it was meaningful because there's a galactic component which they weren't able to subtract out. So I don't think that's, I don't think that FRB constraint is serious at the moment, at least.
Okay. Okay, thanks.
I just want to make a general comment. All the competing models to resolve the Hubble tension, they favor something happened in the early universe. So in order to compensate for the lowering of the sound horizon, you need something to happen before the surface of last scattering. And so in your case, you produce a small inhomogeneity due to the magnetic fields. Mm-hmm. And you have the number 0.05 nanogauss. Now, one of the problems is that you have to know what's going on before the surface of last scattering. And we can't do that because we have this curtain due to the surface of last scattering. So you have to measure the magnetic field before the surface of last scattering. However, you say that if you redshift it, you do get a consistent answer. Mm-hmm. You have to measure something in physics to make sure that you got the right answer.
So, yeah. So if I understand your comment correctly, you're saying, is there a way to directly measure magnetic field at redshift around last scattering? Is there a way to do it directly as opposed to just relying on the kind of evidence we have shown? And in that case, the answer would be yes. So as I mentioned, spectral distortions would be one way. So there would be probing the presence of these magnetic fields at sort of a few decades in redshifts before last scattering. And if we're lucky, maybe Faraday rotation, that would be quite a direct way to look at magnetic fields at that redshift. And then there are all these ways to look at them at lower redshifts, which you could then also predict what you should see at low redshift and compare to what you observe.
Yeah, because the other models, for example, dark energy, modifying, but we can't measure dark energy. So, and modified gravity is difficult to do the measurements.
I agree. I think our model in that sense is quite unique, that it doesn't, we didn't invent any new physics and it's highly testable.
Well, you do invent an inhomogeneous cosmology.
No, but
not the standard.
This inhomogeneous cosmology was predicted from purely known textbook physics by Karsten 10 years ago, before the Hubble tension.
No, I published a paper almost 30 years ago doing this, where I predicted that the Hubble constants would change from the late universe to the early universe. It's published in Physical Review.
So I'm not an expert, so maybe I can ask a question. So did I understand correctly in your story that as far as your CMB fits go, it didn't really matter about magnetic fields. You had a model of clumping in the baryon density, and that was what you're fitting for at some level.
Yes. The model is just a model for clumping. It's not specific to how the clumping was generated.
Right. So that means if someone else were to come along and say, I have another reason why the clumping happens, all of your fits in principle might apply to that as long as they don't change something else in the CMB.
At least at the level of this model, yes. I mean, the precise shape of the probability distribution function you would get from magnetic fields versus another way of generating clumping would be different. But if you just do what we did, it's not specific to any way of changing.
And the connection.
If you have a good idea, that to produce clumping.
No, but I just kind of I'm way behind all of you. So that, but for the magnetic field part of it, when you quote the magnetic field numbers, so there's the model that you kind of sketched with the fluid dynamics of that's predicting what the clumping would have been as a function of what the magnetic field properties are.
Yeah.
And in that is there you know, the way you described it, you had a power spectrum. Is that essentially all you're using? That the you have to choose something like the power spectrum for the magnetic field as a function, you know, how it scales as a function of K, say.
So the power spectrum does make a difference, but the clumping effect that you get at 1 kiloparsec scale is largely independent of the spectrum of the magnetic field. All that matters is how much energy you have in the magnetic field on 1 kiloparsec scale. What the shape of the spectrum is on other scales is not that important. But the spectral shape is important for the previous and subsequent evolution of the magnetic field.
Right. That's the stuff you mentioned at the very end of your talk. Yeah.
Yeah, and so I think it will be important for the shape of the probability distribution function. And that's what we're looking at now.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Could I ask about the, so first of all, I think you had mentioned this and I just need it repeated. The possibility of detecting Faraday rotation depends on whether the spectrum is the sort of scale invariant one or the blue one predicted by a phase transition. Did you say that?
Yeah.
And which is the one which is detectable and which is not?
The scale invariant is easier to detect because in that case you would have rotation on larger scales that you can actually deduce from CMB.
But will it be possible for upcoming Faraday constraints to rule out the scale invariant possibility and favor the other one, or is it not?
I did this forecast for CMBS4, and the best you can do with CMBS4, assuming some optimistic yet a bit realistic assumptions about foregrounds, etc., is 0.1 nanogauss. That's the sensitivity level.
I see. So it's just barely, not quite.
So if it's there at 0.1 nanogauss, you might see something, but if it's 0.05, you would not.
Another question is, if it is from a phase transition, is it basically what is the predicted magnetic field from the, maybe this is also partially a question for Tanmay, what is the predicted magnetic field from the electroweak phase transition, and how does that compare to this, to the one needed here?
Devon, do you want to answer?
That's best for Tommy to answer.
So from the electroweak, it seems certain that there will be magnetic fields produced at the phase transition. But for all logic points to that, they'd be on small scales, which means that at the most, in the most optimistic scenario, you would have magnetic fields on, let's say, kiloparsecs to maybe tens of kiloparsec scales, with some spectrum beyond that. But it depends on whether the magnetic field is helical or not, and because helical magnetic fields evolve differently than non-helical magnetic fields. But to get helicity at the electroweak phase transition, you would need some new sources of CP violation, for example. And it's not clear, to answer your question, I mean, strictly within the standard model, I see that there's a magnetic field, but I don't think it's sufficient to give what Levon and what other observations seem to be.
And just to make sure I understand why. On the one hand, you said it's on relatively short scales, only going up to say kiloparsecs or something. Now that's okay from their standpoint, isn't it? Don't they only need it on kiloparsec scales?
Yeah, that would be okay from there.
But and so the other thing is, if it is helical, then it persists.
So this tens of kiloparsec scales is on the assumption that it is helical.
We don't need.
Whereas you're saying without additional sources of CP violation, it's hard to get it to be purely helical. And if not, it would be on even smaller scales.
Yes, it would be on even smaller scales. Now, I don't fully know the structure of the, say, without helicity, there would be, but the tail would be very small, presumably. So that's something that we are actually working on right now, doing some simulations of the electroweak phase transition and trying to find out the magnetic fields. We can add in ad hoc CP violating terms and see what kind of helicity we can get. But at the moment, the standard electroweak model doesn't seem to be suitable for explaining. But then we know that the standard model has other problems, like it doesn't explain the baryon asymmetry, which also requires CP violation. So maybe there is something tying together over here, that if you had additional sources of CP violation, then maybe you could get helical magnetic fields and the baryon asymmetry. I don't have answers to all that.
And is it relevant whether the phase transition is first or second order or a continuous crossover, or is it only matter that you know, the assumption is the only key thing that the field be uncorrelated on larger than the Hubble scale at the phase transition time?
So we've done simulations with where there was a sort of a rolling Higgs field, but no bubble in the usual sense of a first order transition. And we found magnetic fields being produced over there, and actually a relatively strong magnetic field. It was like maybe 10% of the energy of the false vacuum went into the magnetic field. And then there are some general arguments that if the Higgs is rolling in different directions in different places, something like the Kibble mechanism, then that itself would give you magnetic fields. So I think there are general arguments, and then there are the simulations that do show production of magnetic fields at the electroweak phase transition.
But even if it's not first order.
Even if it's not first order, and it's not, but it's not clear if it's that sufficient to explain observation.
Okay.
Levon, your opinion. Is this 4.2 sigma tension, Hubble tension, settled? I mean, are there systematic errors in the shoes and so on? But there's a measurement by Friedman for the tip of the red giants, which gets 69 kilometers per second per megaparsec. Do you think it's resolved? Is there a tension? Is there a systematic error somewhere in the late time universe measurements?
It doesn't look very likely that. So I don't think it's resolved. It's definitely not resolved. There is indeed this difference between the measurement by Wendy Friedman and the other supernovae-based or different calibration methods used to extract H0 from supernovae. But even with that, it's generally higher than what you get from BAO and CMB type estimates. Now, the tension is quite critical now. I think it's the biggest problem in cosmology, at least from that observational perspective. Yeah.
I see that Neil has his hand up.
Yeah.
Oh, hey, yeah, thanks. So I was just wondering what happens to these order one, you know, baryon fluctuations after recombination.
That's a good question. I mean, they would still be there. And that question has been asked before. They would still be there, and I guess they would in some way in speed up or enhance the growth of baryon in homogeneities, but whether that's enough to lead to an observable effect in something, that we kind of thought about it briefly, and we couldn't think of a signature that would be prominent enough.
Well, if they're not, you know, genes stable, then they mm-hmm. will seed structure formation at very early times. Right, so then it'll be some like large excess of small scale structure, which then could, you know, be tested, I guess, using gravitational lensing measurements.
Could I add?
Karsten thought about it a bit more than I did. So
yeah, well, I had a bit more time ahead. But you know, they're not genes unstable. They are below the gene's mass.
Okay, so they are gene stabilized.
Sorry?
So they are genes stabilized, you're saying, you know.
Yeah, genes stable, yeah. They're below the gene's mass. They will not collapse. They will just stick around, you know, and maybe do some inhomogeneous effects on the 21 centimeter line, or maybe sort of like influence the first formation of first stars, but there's, like Levon said rightly, right now we can think of a very clear signature.
Yeah, so I guess that they would also seed relative velocities between the baryons and dark matter, right? Because,
yes.
Yeah.
On small scales, yeah.
Yeah, that's right. And that can show up even on large scales. Okay. Yeah,
that would be very nice. Yeah, if anybody has an idea, I encourage them to think about it.
Actually, following up on that, it seems that this gonna kind of wreak havoc on dispersion measures, because if you have order one fluctuations in electron density and kiloparsec scales, any line of sight, say, to fast radio bursts, would go through these guys, and you could get, I guess, large fluctuations in dispersion measures. I mean, that just seems something that could happen if they remain order one.
But there is a long period of time between redshift 1000 and the redshift at which you see this radio burst. Yeah. I mean, things would equilibrate into a completely different configuration. But you would expect this baryon clumps eventually to start following dark matter, just like any other.
But these are on very small scales where, well.
Kiloparsec, yeah, I guess it's kind of.
Yeah. So, I mean, the question is what happens to them? I mean, do they, I mean, the co-moving scale is kiloparsec, but I mean, do they follow the expansion of the universe, or would they become a smaller or bigger? Yeah. Okay. I don't.
Gravity doesn't seem to play an important role there because they're small for individual units. It's two, maybe one could think of, you know, several of them clustering. They seem to stick around, as our simulations show. They are much larger when it's an inflationary scale invariant fields, and much smaller when it's when it is causal, like magnetic fields with a blue spectral index. So, yeah, I mean, like I said again, you know, I don't know. Maybe they have some effect on dispersion measurements, but they're on small scales, you know.
Mm-hmm. The magnitude stays order one, you're saying?
No, not really. Maybe if Levon could show the plot from Andre, and I mean, well, in the simulations, they do not stay order unity if it's a blue spectrum. Then they're actually fairly small. If it's inflationary fields, then they are staying on the level of 0.1, something like this.
You want me to show your paper with
with Andrea, yeah, the plot.
The paper, the actual paper.
No, not the paper.
Just you know, Karsten, I don't know if you have it there. You could also share your screen and show it to it if you want.
I mean, I can.
It's in your talk.
Oh, it is in my, mean this one?
Yes. Okay. There you see the density fluctuations with the thin lines.
Oh, okay. Yeah? Yes.
And you see like this thin solid line is the line like which is for inflationary fields. And you see like up to essentially the present time, like of course there's no structural formation in those simulations, but up to the present time, you still have some clumping, like it levels out. And the dashed thin line is the one where you have a blue spectrum, so phase transition like the fields. And there you see the clumping drops quite considerably after a combination. You don't have much clumping there anymore. You have clumping factors of order of 0.1% at the present time.
What were the thick lines in that plot?
The magnetic field strength. It's a double plot.
I see. Thank you.
Shows magnetic field and clumping at the same time. So I would suspect that if it's inflationary fields, maybe there is an effect.
Maybe you could explain repeating fast radio bursts, although maybe not with the periodicity, not the periodic ones, but if you guys have multiple lensing or, I don't know, Kosci crossings from these guys. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I don't know much about this. Levon, do you know much about this?
No, that's a bit out of my depth. Yeah.
Neither do I.
All right. Well, this was a very exciting talk. Thank you so much, Levon. And also thanks to Karsten and Tanmay.